Right. That one you can eat. That's mint. The one next to it, I think you can't. And the one above me, ow, if I can reach my way through the thorns, that is going to give you a nasty stomachache. Hello and welcome to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. This is the show that takes questions about all things scientific and finds answers. And I'm in my back garden looking at the surprising number of plants with the potential to do me harm, if I were stupid enough to try and eat them. You see, it's all part of a clever strategy to stop animals from turning plants into a meal. But plants face all sorts of threats, from bacteria, viruses, and fungi that cause diseases. Now, over the past 18 months, we've all learned a bit more about how our immune systems work. But how would plants respond to a pandemic? Once they've had the equivalent of a plant cold, will they deal with it better the next time? Can they remember that? That's what one listener wants to know.
My name is John Kennelly. I live in Edmonton, Alberta. And my question is, do trees and plants in general have memory?
When you say memory, what made you think about trees and memory?
Well, I've always been interested in trees, also plants in general, because I'm an avid gardener. And I've often been amazed at how trees can withstand all kinds of insult and survive for up to 1,000 years. And it occurred to me, they must have some process that they learn from previous insults or attacks, whether by insects or bacteria or whatever. And are they better prepared to withstand that attack the second time based on the experience of the first time?
Thank you, John. John mentions trees because they're a long-lived species, so it makes sense for them to remember past run-ins with danger. In this episode, I'll be getting up close and personal with some trees which are experiencing something a bit like time travel, a future stress that hasn't actually happened yet. Where are we right now?
We are in the middle of an experimental plot where we're simulating the future atmospheric conditions of 2050 for the future levels of CO2.
To see how trees and the woodland react to
those
changes.
Exactly, to see how a temperate, deciduous woodland responds to elevated levels of CO2.
As the COP26 climate conference looms, we'll be meeting the scientists who want to know today what effect elevated carbon dioxide levels might have on trees in the future. More on that later, but first I think I need to understand the basics of plant immunity. Most plant scientists studying this need something that grows a lot faster than a tree. If you're poking a plant for some sort of immune response, it's much quicker and easier to go with the lab rat of the plant world, a weed called Arabidopsis. Over at Sheffield University in the north of England, that's what plant biologist Jurjen Ton uses in his research. So just to check, plants do have an immune system.
Oh yes, yes. Plants in particular need to have a very efficient immune system for two important reasons. Firstly, they sit at the bottom of the food chain, so there are a lot of opportunistic organisms out there, including insect herbivores and microbial pathogens. We want to tap into that biochemical energy that is stored in plants. The other reason is plants are rooted to the ground. They cannot escape from the stressful conditions in their environment. So they need to have a very efficient immune system to fight off all these opportunistic organisms out there.
Okay, so they can't run away and everything wants to eat it.
Exactly.
But I know my immune system is all of these cells that kind of circulate around my body in the bloodstream, and plants don't have that.
So plants, like most other higher organisms, have a very sophisticated innate immune system, and it allows almost every cell in the plant to respond to alarm signals. These are often chemicals or chemical signatures that can be recognized by specific plant receptors. And these receptors recognize attack either directly by binding to very specific chemicals that are unique to the attacker, or they can detect the attack indirectly by binding to what we call damaged cell signals that indicate that the cell is losing its integrity. For instance, chunks of DNA that should be inside the cell and then start floating around in the space between the cells. And once they bind to these chemicals, they activate a multi-layered defense response. And this operates according to a pre-programmed genetic blueprint that is present in nearly every cell and that the plants are essentially born with.
So that sounds like the plant has this very good defense system baked into every cell. Its innate system can detect foreign chemicals or loose bits of half-munched DNA and spring into action. If anything, it's so efficient that this part of the immune system needs to be used pretty sparingly, says Jurian.
If you express too much of it, it can come with very significant costs. And this is why the innate immune response is often very quickly switched off once the attacker has been fought off. If it's always switched on, then plants can actually kill themselves. So it's very important for a plant to regulate this very tightly.
Wait, why can it kill itself if it's always switched on?
Well, production of defense mechanisms requires a lot of energy. And there's also another element to it. So for diseases that rely on living tissues, plants use a defense strategy that is actually quite unique to plants. What they do is they induce programmed cell death around the sites of infection. So the plant essentially deprives the pathogen from its food source. So that's a very, very efficient way of killing off a disease. But of course, too much cell death is not good either, because the plant loses its ability to photosynthesize and grow.
So the downsides to the innate or built-in immune system are that, firstly, it can work by killing the cells around the diseased cells, a bit like chopping off a toe to cure a fungal nail infection. I mean, it does the job, but it's a trick you can only employ so many times. And secondly, it also appears that when the switch is flicked on, to put the plant into defence mode, it takes it out of growing mode, which is bad because, as Jurian pointed out, plants are the base of this planet's food chain. They grow, we eat. Luckily, they also have another approach. It's what listener John was asking about as memory. This is the adaptive immune system. So, is it like ours? Surely not. Plants don't have a bloodstream to circulate immune cells around its tissues. So how does it work?
So this is still an area of ongoing research, but what we do know is that plants build up this immune memory upon prior exposure to pests and diseases, which allows them then to respond faster and stronger to attack much later on in their life cycle. And this is what is often also referred to as priming. Now the interesting thing is this memory, this priming, can be maintained for longer periods of time. And it's also less costly to the plant because it doesn't involve the ongoing expression of these costly defense mechanisms. They are merely sensitized, they are primed.
Priming is a bit like creating a memory, only I'd keep a memory in my head. Plants don't have brains, but what they can do is store memories as changes on their DNA. Not to the DNA sequence itself, but to little chemical tags that sit on the genome and affect the genes in it. We've come to the subject of epigenetics. I like to think of it like this. If a plant's DNA is a symphony, where each gene is a note, then epigenetics are all of the other instructions on that sheet music. So how loud or soft or long to play that note? Let's hear how that analogy works in practice in plants.
An epigenetic trait is a trait that is determined by chemical modifications to the DNA itself or proteins that are closely associated with the DNA that can be passed on through cell division and encode information about the speed and intensity by which defense genes can be activated. Only relatively recently we discovered that some of that priming can be passed on to following generations, although it really depends on the nature of the stress and also the frequency and intensity by which these parental plants experience the disease stress.
CrowdScience did a program about epigenetics called Can Your Lifestyle Be Passed On to Future Generations?, which you can find in our extensive podcast back catalogue. Because the idea that traumas from my life could be passed down to my descendants is a beguiling idea. Spoiler, there's no evidence. In fact, one of the points of reproduction is to make shiny new humans free from epigenetic tags. But plants work differently for one key reason.
The way I put it is that plants do not have the means to really communicate to their offspring. I'm constantly trying to talk sense into my 8-year-old son, and I hope it has a long-lasting effect. So we have the ability to communicate with our offspring. Plants can't really do that, you see, so they use epigenetic mechanisms perhaps to pass on that memory.
So there are two parts to the plant immune system, the inbuilt bit, which is in the genes, and the adaptive bit, which can sometimes be passed on via the epigenome. both approaches come back to genes, which produce chemicals. Those chemicals can make the plant taste less good to a pest, but they can also signal to other bits of the plant and other plants. CrowdScience have made a video about something called the Wood Wide Web, this amazing network of fungi that trees use to talk to each other underground. Search for BBC and Wood Wide Web. It's worth a few minutes of your life. But plants have another way of talking to each other without sound. They use smell to convey danger.
Some plants are very smelly, and when they're damaged, particularly by caterpillars, by herbivores, they also emit airborne signals, odours, that can recruit natural enemies of the plant. And that's called indirect induced defence. Now, some of these volatiles can also prime the immune system of neighbouring plants. So if you imagine that there is a population of plants and there is a certain outbreak in the middle of that population, the plants that are affected by the pest, they start emitting these airborne signals, and that sort of forewarns the immune system of neighboring plants. There's even evidence that plants can encrypt their airborne signal, because of course, as soon as you start emitting signals into the air, they become public domain. And other plants, potentially plants that are competing with you, can take benefit of that. So there is some evidence in the literature to suggest that species or even subspecies of a plant, they encrypt their signature in such a way that can only be recognized by conspecifics and not by other plants with whom they are potentially competing.
Wow. It's like being in a WhatsApp group. And if you're not the same species, you don't get those messages.
Absolutely, yes.
If you've been outside in the park just after the grass has been cut, and you're breathing in that sweet, fresh, grassy smell, well, I'm sorry to ruin that, but what you're actually smelling is the heady perfume of eau de panic as grass plants signal to each other that they're being attacked. But can we help them out too? Urien and his team are looking into whether we could use priming and the subsequent immune memory to create plant vaccines.
We here in Sheffield have also been doing a lot of research into other chemicals that are particularly good in triggering that immune memory. This is with a wider objective to exploit this knowledge in crop protection. We're looking at a class of chemicals that are called beta amino acids. And some of these are really good in vaccinating plants. So they trigger a strong immune response. It is relatively long lasting and it offers broad spectrum protection. So what's not to like? Well, it's rarely 100% effective. And then the other thing is there are still side effects. They are minor, but they are there. And they can affect the reproduction. They can also affect the growth. So we need to look at that as well.
This broad spectrum immunity that vaccines can offer plants is key. It makes it much harder for the pathogens to beat the plant immune system, as it offers, like the name suggests, a broad spectrum of defence. This is especially important in our agriculture, as it's often a monoculture, rows upon rows of the same identical plants. In 1845, Ireland was plunged into a devastating famine when their main crop, potatoes, were infected by a fungal disease. The crop failure led to over 1 million deaths. Nowadays, rice is the staple food for more than half the world's population, and over at Duke University in the USA, Professor Jinyan Dong is working to prevent rice falling prey to a similar fate.
We tested two major rice diseases. One is rice blast, that's the top rice disease, and also rice blight. So the engineered rice plant is resistant to both rice blast and rice blight.
In recent years, farmers have used pesticides to keep rice diseases at bay. Jinyan's work offers an alternative. The team knew there was a gene which can switch the plant into defence mode, making it more resistant against disease. But when it was switched on, it stayed on all of the time, which made the crop grow less well, which is obviously bad for agriculture. So Jinyan replaced the switch with one the team had modified, which crucially only switches on when it's needed. So once you've put this improved switch in, does that then get bred into the rice? Is it kind of improved forever?
Yes, so it's integrated into the rice genome. It's just like adding a new book to the library. So the information is stored in the genome.
It can't be that good, though. I mean, is it effective 100% of the time?
No, it's not. So it's just like the antibiotics, right? So we have many different types of broad-spectrum antibiotics, but they all have preferences. So it's the same here. This is broad-spectrum, but not against all pathogens.
I would have been worried if you'd said, yes, it is 100% efficient, to be honest, because what I'm learning about this whole field of immunity is that it's kind of a bit of an arms race between, well, every different living thing that's trying to protect itself against everything else. And so presumably at some point, if you engineer this to give the crop a bit of a leg up, the pathogens will work out a way around it at some point, right?
That's for certain. But I think it's harder for pathogens to figure out a way because this is broad spectrum resistance, right? So it involves many genes. So it's harder to evolve against multiple targets than just a single target. And I also think that this inducibility of this type of resistance also give the plants more advantage in this arms race. So you don't really show what you have all the time, only when you get infection.
I'm wondering about the implications of this innovation for biodiversity and agriculture. I mean, could it reduce the amount of pesticides that are used?
That's the whole point, right? So for plant disease control in agriculture, there are two major strategies. One is using chemicals, one is using genetics. So what we're talking about here is to use genetic protection to reduce the use of chemical application. Because when you use pesticide, fungicide, the impact on the environment is really significant. Is a major source of pollution.
We've heard how important a strong immune system is for plants, which have defences written into their DNA, and adaptive responses, which can be passed on in their seeds through epigenetics. We've also heard how scientists can tinker with these defences to improve crops. But all of this research is mainly done in crops, and also that lab rat plant Arabidopsis, useful because it has a short life cycle of 2 to 3 months. But John's asking about trees because, as he points out, they live a really long time. The oldest trees, tragically under threat from wildfires at the moment, are the bristlecone pines of California, some of which have lived more than 5,000 years. Surely a plant can't get that old without a pretty impressive immune system? One woman who'll know is Estrella Luna Diaz. She's a lecturer in plant pathology at the University of Birmingham, and she works with Birmingham Institute of Forest Research. So, Estrella, do trees have the same immune system as small plants?
We know that the innate immune system of a tree is very similar to mechanisms that a plant has. However, we do think that there are very good differences between herbaceous plants and trees that allow trees to actually live much longer.
So does that mean they can remember that they've already encountered, say, a certain type of caterpillar or a certain type of disease, and that can help them overcome it next time?
So we do know that trees have memory. However, we don't know how much a tree can remember from a stress point of view. And this is what we are actually going to be looking into in the project that we are running at the moment that is called MEMBRA.
MEMBRA stands for Understanding Memory of Trees for Better Resilience and Adaptation. Estrella wants to know whether trees remember stress and how. For me, stress is a work deadline. For trees, it's more fundamental. It's things like disease or not enough water. So how do you tell if a tree is stressed?
We have trees that have suffered from a particular stress. We know that from past records, and also we are going to be able to identify that stress from the size of the tree rings. So we are going to do some tree coring to understand how the rings of the tree have grown.
And when you core a tree, I imagine it's a bit like coring an apple. You sort of poke a needle into it and take a sample of the rings. Does a small difference between two rings mean a stressful year?
A ring that is smaller can indicate that the tree has not really grown that much that year because there was some kind of stress. And because we can link it with, for example, the rain that we got at that time, we can say actually this ring, this period, corresponds to a period of drought. So that's when we will be starting to look at whether that stress left a signature in the epigenetics of that tree.
Do we know yet whether a tree's experience has an effect on the immune system of their seedlings?
We definitely know that there is a transfer of information. There has been quite a lot of studies done when that trees have been exposed to stress and then the progenies have actually behaved differently to that stress. So they have been more resistant or more resilient to a particular stress, because we know that some epigenetic changes, not all, but some of them, can be transmitted to following generations. And this is what we will be looking at in the project. So we want to know whether that stress is leaving a signature that it could be understood as a memory, and whether that memory, that signature, is passed to following generations.
Imagine you're a tree and have lived for hundreds of years. Maybe it's quite useful to have a memory passed on in your epigenome to your seedlings that 1947 was quite a dry summer. Or maybe that stressful year is best forgotten. Do plants ever wipe their epigenetic memories?
So this is something that we will be looking into. But we can have hypotheses. So our hypothesis would be that depending on the level of that stress, so if it was a really long-lasting drought of a few years, then maybe the tree can remember it for a long time because it needs to adapt to that hostile environment. Now, maybe the hypothesis could be the other way around. Like if it's maybe it was a very dry July, for instance, maybe the tree is not even that bothered and then it forgets within 1 year because that memory of stress is going to be holding it back on its growth, for instance.
So the tree faces a choice whether to grow or whether to hunker down and defend itself, which is why forgetting might be important. I suspect it's a little bit like human stress. Defence, war and battle analogies all spring to mind here. A little bit of stress can prepare a soldier for a fight, but constantly being on danger alert week after week takes its toll. In the future, as the climate changes due to all the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, trees might experience that as environmental stress. Estrella is leading a research team at Birmingham Institute of Forest Research, doing an extraordinary experiment looking at how trees adapt to these future changes by making the future, specifically 2050, a key date for decarbonising deadlines, happen now. It's an experiment called FACE, which CrowdScience went to visit.
I'm Peter Miles. I'm the FACE facility technician at the Birmingham Institute of Forest Research here in Staffordshire.
And what is the FACE experiment?
FACE is free air carbon enrichment, which means it's not enclosed. It's completely exposed to the element. We're at the mercy of the little critters that live here. So we've had a defoliation event twice now where we had caterpillars attack our trees, but
which wouldn't happen if your experiment was in a lab.
That's right, but
there is absolutely no way that you can put this quantity of mature trees, you know, hundreds of years old, in an ancient woodland in an experiment in a lab.
Yeah, we're looking at a forest and an ecosystem that's been here for hundreds of years, and we want to keep it as natural as possible.
As we headed into the experimental plot in the forest, there was a strange mechanical hum which got louder and louder as we walked. And through the gaps in the forestscape, I could see glimpses of stuff that shouldn't be there. So there's elements of woodland that I totally recognise. There's the oak trees, there's holly, there's hazel. There's also, and listeners will hear, some bits that I don't recognise as part of a traditional woodland. There are these sort of systems of big, round, shiny pipes, like a sort of giant loop on one side of me, and then there's this 25-metre tower in front of me, this piece of scaffolding, and you can see huge kind of bolts that have bolted it into the forest floor. And then radiating out, I can see all of these towers sort of in a circle round, I don't know, maybe a few car widths apart, each one. and then a pipe up the side of each tower, and that is pumping out CO2.
That's where the CO2 is introduced into the array. That's right, yeah. That's all part of our CO2 distribution system.
Yep, you heard right. These scientists are pumping carbon dioxide out into the atmosphere. But they aren't needlessly growing their carbon footprint.
This shed here is our control shed. You can hear that whirring, high-pitched noise. It's a bit louder, and that's behind the shed where we have our intake fan, which is drawing in the ambient air. So you said you could see a large cylindrical pipework creating a perimeter. So
that this area with its array or circle of pipes and towers is set up to monitor and release carbon dioxide with exquisite control.
If you need to introduce CO2, those valves will open. And if you put your hand out, you might feel a little breeze ever so gently.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the air of the future you're breathing right there. So we're increasing the CO2 in here by 150 parts per million. That's the projected CO2 level for 2050. So when we started our project in 2014, the global ambient average was 400 parts per million. And already since then, when I checked yesterday, we recorded 414 parts per million in August 2021.
So what's it going to be by 2050?
About 550 parts per million. So quite an increase.
So all of these pipes, all of this quite sophisticated setup is essentially to try and create a little bubble of forest in the UK where all the trees have to live with the elevated levels of CO2 that we're going to have in 2050.
That's correct, yes.
And I suppose why?
We need to understand how these trees, how this whole ecosystem is going to be affected by these increased levels of CO2.
So the team are investigating changes in real time as well as over time. 10 years might seem like quite a long time for a study for us, especially compared to the lab rat Arabidopsis I mentioned at the beginning of the programme. But if you're a 200-year-old mature oak tree, that's just a tiny part of your whole life so far. Estrella and her team will be studying the epigenetic and DNA changes of these trees to see if the changes in environmental conditions has the genetic impact they think it will. And they've got plans for the seeds they're collecting.
So, because trees are so important for capturing CO2, we want to know how trees will actually cope with it. Basically, CO2 for the trees is like fuel. So we would expect that you have more CO2 and then the trees grow more. And that is actually something that we are seeing. But there is a compromise between growth and defense and the capacity of that activation of the immune system. So we know that disease compromises growth, but does growth also compromise the defense? We have seen some indications that elevated CO2 actually makes the plants defend themselves worse against some pathogens. We've seen this in younger trees. So potentially one could hypothesize that the seedling stage is when the tree grows more. So if it has more CO2, it's like happy days, I just keep growing like crazy. And then, you know, I am infected by a pathogen and I actually don't notice because I'm just enjoying my happy life. Yeah, exactly. Whereas in mature trees, we still haven't seen that much evidence of elevated CO2 at those levels changing the immune system. But we have seen that the seedlings of the oak trees that are exposed to elevated CO2 are actually slightly more resistant to some diseases. So we can see the different characteristics emerging that are triggered by this stress that the elevated CO2 causes in the trees.
I would have just expected increased CO2 to be good for trees, but it's clearly not that simple. Recent work showed that it makes some trees grow thicker leaves, which annoyingly makes them less good at taking up CO2. In addition, climate change is happening really fast, while tree growth, traditionally, is not. So knowing how they'll respond in advance is useful for protecting them. And Estrella's team already have the seeds harvested from this window on the future, which may contain the memory of how to adapt. They're going to plant them now, so at least some trees will have a head start on 2050's climate.
We want to understand how trees adapt, how they retain and transmit memory. So we can actually conserve those trees that are more experienced, that they know how to defend themselves, and use those seeds to plant the next generations of forest. Because then in 50 years' time, when we have a very different planet, then they will be more adapted to it already. So our goal is actually to create a memory-inspired forest that hopefully will be more resilient in 50 years' time.
As we head into unknown waters, with levels of carbon dioxide we've not seen on this planet for several million years, plant scientists are trying to understand more about how plants might adapt to these changes. It turns out that, yes, they do have sophisticated immune systems, which, although they don't look much like our own, can turn out levels of biological warfare our bodies wouldn't cope with. I'm thinking of how a plant can starve a pathogen by killing part of itself. Some of these responses are passed on in the DNA, but others are passed down to seedlings as a kind of memory. For humans, storytelling has been the traditional way to hand memories down the generations. And it's funny to think that plants have their own version, little chemical signals that help their offspring against possible future stresses like serious drought, and all without saying a word. Clever old plants.
That's it for this edition of Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. This question was from me, John, in Alberta. This program was presented by Marnie Chesterton and produced by Hannah Fisher. If you have a question for Crowd Science, please send it to crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Now, we've been talking about how plants might adapt to climate change, but can we tempt you with the story of human efforts against climate change?
Oh my God, I didn't realise I could get messages. I just listened to yours. They're amazing.
Let's face it, the news isn't always that positive, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Something strange is going on.
On the People Fixing the World podcast from the BBC World Service, we look for stories about how people are solving even the most difficult problems.
Scientists are pretty convinced that would lower global temperatures.
And we meet the people who are already making things better.
Here we are a bit out of our comfort zone.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
He's going to make it. Come on.
Search for People Fixing the World wherever you get your podcasts.
What drama? I'm so emotional.